Welcome to Space Week, where we bring you weekly space for everyday people. We're your hosts, Paul Miller
and Blake Brown.
Now I'm super excited because this episode is going to be chock full of news on spaceflight and rockets. But don't worry, we still have some astronomy topics to go over, including a quick nightmare fuel segment at the end. So stay tuned.
Yay, nightmare fuel. Why do we continue to include this episode or include this into our episodes?
Why do we include this episode in this episode?
Yeah, my bad.
So kicking things off, I'd like to clarify some things from our last episode, mainly to do with Starship's second flight test.
Right, yeah, we did get some things wrong on that, didn't we?
I think so. We were speculating what could have gone wrong during this test, and I don't think we had all our facts quite right. So if you remember, both stages exploded after hot staging during Starship's second integrated flight test. I don't know why, but SpaceX Extreme wasn't saved, or at least I couldn't find it. We didn't get to watch it live, so we had to watch replays, okay? Most replays make it seem like the stages were closer together when they exploded, which led to Blake and I's theory that maybe they ignited the venting fuel that caused the explosion, if you guys maybe remember.
Yeah, we were wrong.
Yeah, that's actually pretty far from what happened. So instead, you have to find someone who re-uploaded the original stream. So I had to go in, look at all the YouTube videos, and find which one was a re-upload of the original. First off, all engines were lit and nominal all the way through hot staging. Hot staging simply means the second stage ignites before separating instead of after separation. This is because the rockets on the first stage are still lit during this kind of separation. So all engines were good. I think we confused this with their first launch where they lost a few. Okay, you remember that?
Yeah, no. I swear, dude, I read some things about them having some engine failures on it, and that's what... I don't think it was about the first launch either. I think it was about the second launch that I read, and they said, oh yeah, there were some engine failures, but again, this is why we go back and kind of fact check things. Maybe that source that I read, they didn't have the facts right.
Well, you're not completely wrong.
Okay.
After hot staging is where things got interesting.
All right.
Okay, what happens is the first stage shuts down all but three engines. So you got like, what is it, close to 30 Raptor engines on that thing?
I forget.
Well, they shut down all but three. Starship lights off all its engines and separates and flies away.
Makes sense.
This happened perfectly and was honestly pretty cool to watch. What happens next is the first stage uses those three engines to turn itself around, like it literally does a somersault. Once it does that, it reignites the inner ring of engines to slow itself and bring itself back to the landing zone. Well, looking at the telemetry, about half of the engines failed to reignite right away, which likely led to an imbalance, and most eventually came back online, but it was probably too late. And I'm now guessing it succumbed to too much stress on the structure, causing it to deform and explode. I believe they even made comments that they'll be looking into ways in the future to minimize the stresses endured during the somersault maneuver. So we'll see. Maybe they'll throttle back. Maybe they'll decrease the rate that they spin the booster around. I don't know.
I believe the solution would probably be decrease the rate of the turn.
Of the rotation.
Because that's a lot of torque on it, you know?
So. Yes. So you aren't completely wrong. There were definitely engine failures, but they weren't actually during initial ascent.
Okay, that makes sense.
It was after staging and when they tried to reignite. That's pretty much what happened to the first stage. The second stage, aka Starship, almost made it all the way to engine cutoff. They were so close, and then it exploded. So Starship was way, way far away, right, from the first stage.
Right.
Almost out of view from the cameras on the ground when the explosion occurred. And supposedly the cause of that one was due to the propellant venting. You know, I don't know. But
yeah, and I do remember seeing some tweets or X's, whatever we're calling them nowadays.
Yeah, some X's.
from Elon saying that if it had a payload, it would have made it to orbit.
Yes.
Because I do believe they had to vent the propellant to get it under a certain weight in order to make it survive reentry. or something like that.
Something like that. Yeah, it was something strange just with the configuration it was in being empty. So yeah, so our original theory for Blake and I was that it had vented fuel, and that because the replays we originally saw, they looked so close together, we thought maybe the venting fuel ignited both stages and they both blew up. But in reality, what happened was that first stage separated. It didn't reignite all the engines. It suffered a lot of stress and it blew up. And then a couple minutes or so later, I don't remember how long, Starship blew up literally just before engine cutoff. I mean, it was extremely close. But yeah, I hope that clears some things up. I definitely want to make sure that we have our facts straight. And if we don't, we correct them as soon as possible. But all right, on to the new stuff. Finally, China started things off on January 17th with the launch of Tianzhou 7. We'll say I pronounced that right. Sure. Okay. It was a resupply vessel.
Close enough, right?
And to the Tiangong Space Station. It was the sixth cargo craft for the station and mainly carried a bunch of fresh fruit. It was launched atop a Long March 7 rocket, a medium to heavy lift liquid fueled launch vehicle. Next up was Axiom 3. So Axiom Space continues to move forward with their commercial short stage crews on their third mission now to the ISS. The launch lifted off right on schedule from pad 39A at KSC on the 18th. If you remember from last episode, the crew was comprised of members from all different countries, which is pretty cool. Mission commander Michael Lopez is of dual nationality, American and Spanish. Mission pilot Walter Villade, I think is how he pronounces his name, he's from Italy. Mission specialist Alper Gezeravci from Turkey. He's the first Turkish astronaut. I think I butchered his name last episode too, so hey, I apologize.
Yeah, we try.
Seriously, like we'll look it up and everything and practice it 10 times and we still get it wrong.
Yep.
And mission specialist Marcus Wandt from Sweden. They'll be spending 2 weeks aboard the ISS, so I'm sure we'll have more to cover on them here coming next month. We had three Starlink launches in a row, so I'm just going to rattle those off. Starlink 711 lifted off on the 23rd out of Vandenberg in California. It took 22 satellites to orbit with the stage landing on the drone ship, Of Course I Still Love You. It was the 16th flight of this particular booster. I think our record so far is like 18 or something like that.
Yeah, somewhere around there. It's quite a lot for what they do.
Yes. Starlink 6-38 launched January 28th from LC-39A at Kennedy in Florida, taking 23 satellites up and landing on the drone ship A Shortfall of Gravitas. And finally, Starlink 7-12 took 22 satellites up after launching from Vandenberg just roughly 5 hours after 6-38 launched in Florida, landing on the drone ship Of Course I Still Love You again. So that's pretty cool. They're doing like a bunch of these double headers now, launching one off the West Coast, one off the East Coast. So that's pretty neat. China had a cargo mission to their station, and we had one to the ISS. NG-20 was the name of the mission, launched using Northrop Grumman's Cygnus cargo freighter atop a Falcon 9 January 30th. The launch vehicle was changed from Grumman's own Antares 230 rocket to SpaceX's Falcon 9 after the war in Ukraine ceased production for the Antares program. Last but certainly not least, our buddies at Rocket Lab launched a mission out of New Zealand titled Four of a Kind, January 31st, with their Electron rocket. It was their first Electron launch of the year and 43rd overall. The mission deployed four space situational awareness satellites for Spire Global's customer NorthStar Earth and Space. NorthStar satellites, built and operated by Spire, will be the first to simultaneously monitor all near-Earth orbits from space. This will drastically enhance the level of space situational awareness services to the global community with precise information for space object detection, tracking, orbit determination, collision avoidance, navigation, and proximity alerts. So now instead of just relying on ground tracking stations, we'll have satellite tracking satellites.
That sounds like some kind of Inception type thing.
Kind of.
Close enough, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the topic of launches, we actually have something really exciting that happened with Virgin Galactic. They've achieved their sixth flight And this sixth flight is one of the final flights of the VSS Unity, which is the little ship that actually drops from the carrier ship and then launches and rockets into space to carry the passengers into space, right?
The rocket space frame thing that we couldn't think of the name of?
Yes. I believe it's a VSS Eve, but I could be wrong. Anyways, you heard it right. Final flights, yes.
So are they upgrading this thing? Are they changing it?
Is
it
going to actually upgrade it. They plan to retire the VSS Unity and upgrade it to what they're calling the Delta class vehicle.
Oh, I think we mentioned these.
I believe so, yeah.
These are like the new ones that they hope to be able to launch more frequently or something.
Exactly. So the key difference between the VSS Unity and the Delta class ship, I don't think they have a name for it just yet, is the time between flights is planned to be much shorter. So each Delta vehicle will be able to fly up to twice per week, in which case the Unity vehicle can only fly once a month at most.
Oh.
So huge difference right out the gate. The Delta vehicle is scheduled for test flights in 2025 and hopefully commercial flights beginning in 2026.
Yeah, hopefully we'll see those prices like slash to 1/8.
I highly doubt it, actually, just because of how expensive it is to get up there in the first place.
But yeah, operations costs. My gosh.
So on board the Unity for its sixth flight, titled Galactic 06, were four passengers and then the two crew members, of course, including the first Ukrainian woman to ever reach space, Lena Borozdina, I believe is how you pronounce it.
It's a tough one.
We try. Anyways, hats off to the continued success of Virgin Galactic, and maybe one day I'll be able to afford their steep price of $450,000. I'd love to go to space one day, but I don't know if I can afford that.
You mean to tell me even if we get this thing like to a quarter, it's still going to be $100,000?
Yes.
Oh, man.
Which is ironically, I think, the price for the New Shepard flight.
Really?
Blue Origin, yeah.
Oh, you know what? Yeah, you might be right.
Yeah.
Well, one of the two. We'll see. Now, I'm sure those of you who have been with us for the past few episodes are eager to finally hear the outcome of Japan's Moon Sniper lander. Well, I'm happy to say that the SLIM, or Smart Lander for Investigating Moon, successfully landed upside down.
What?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
You're going to find out.
Okay.
The craft entered lunar orbit on Christmas Day last year and made its landing January 19th. However, controllers weren't able to confirm the status of SLIM due to issues with solar panel power generation. Other systems were working as intended, though, and the lander was able to deploy its two small rovers, LEV-1 and LEV-2. So power was quickly running down on SLIM, and luckily they programmed an automatic hibernate mode to prevent it from an unrecoverable shutdown. That would have been bad. Days later, SLIM came back alive and was able to transmit a picture taken by LEV-2, giving hint as to why the solar panels aren't producing power as expected. The picture shows, in full color, SLIM standing on its head. The reason for SLIM's tumble, here you go, was due to an engine failure during descent. It's honestly pretty comical. Looks like something I'd do in Kerbal Space Program.
Yeah, you and me both.
Yeah. Nonetheless, the landing makes Japan the fifth country to land on the moon following the U.S., Soviet Union. I say that because I don't believe Russia has been since the collapse of the Union. China and India. Speaking of which, the U.S. plans to reach the moon again soon with Intuitive Machines IM-1 lander, which we'll cover the launch of in mid-February, so stay tuned.
Many milestones are being reached these days in the space industry, and something that's really cool is China's space station, the Qiangong core module named Tianhe, I don't know.
I'm looking at it. There's no way.
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of wish I knew how, but I don't know. I tried. Anyways, the core module has achieved 1,000 days in low Earth orbit. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, man, that's what, over 3 years?
Just over.
Yeah, 365.
Probably just some change from 3 years.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter, though. That's still pretty cool.
Yep.
It's a big milestone and a showcase of the engineering behind the module to survive the harshness of space. As we all know, space is very harsh. It's very hard. And, well, making things that don't explode, as we can tell, is quite impressive.
Yes. I was going to say also just being able to dodge all the international debris, too.
Yeah, yeah, from all the satellites and stuff like that, you know, just all of the space junk from Kessler syndrome, you know, whole ordeal.
List goes on, yep.
Yeah. There's still a long way to go and achieve, however, as China plans to have the station operating for at least a decade.
Wow.
In comparison to the ISS, the Tiangong is only 20% the mass of the massive 460-ton ISS station currently.
I didn't know it weighed that much. I guess, man, that makes sense, though.
It's huge. I mean, if you remember, there were how many space shuttle missions to assemble it? I can't remember.
Oh, just on assembly? I have no idea. But it was, yeah, it's a lot. I mean, you think about it. God, that's a lot of weight to bring to space.
Oh, yeah, 460 tons. You know, you're talking, if I remember right, Falcon 9 is like a 20-ton payload and Falcon 9 Heavy or the Falcon Heavies.
Oh, I'm just throwing numbers out there. I think Heavy is something like 40 or even 70 ton or something like that. Nine is somewhere like between 10 and 20. I don't know. I could be completely wrong, though.
Yeah. I actually did look up the Falcon 9 for another segment that we'll talk about here in a minute, and it was like 20.
Okay. Well, there we go.
Yeah. Anyways, so China's Human Spaceflight Agency wants to expand the Tiangong beyond its current configuration of three modules. So they'll be building it up kind of like we have the ISS. They're also opening the station to commercial operations and civilian astronauts, whereas previously it was only for Air Force pilots considered for their astronaut selection.
Kind of following our same suit there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we started out in our space history, of course, only accepting Air Force pilots, I think, and also just like military pilots.
It was mostly Navy test pilots.
And that's right. Yeah.
And then Air Force came on board. And yeah, a lot of the early Air Force guys kind of found themselves or thought to be at a disadvantage to the Navy test pilot guys. But yeah, we started bringing them on board, and then we finally started taking civilians, too.
Yeah, and, you know, we're at that point. They are reaching that point, too, which is great.
Yes.
In addition to that, Tiangong will be opened up to international experiments and astronauts, which is great news for further jolly space cooperation.
That's awesome. I had no idea that they were opening it up internationally. That's going to be cool.
Yeah. Now, when it comes to China, kind of just to bring smidge of politics, we'll see what they actually allow as far as international astronauts go.
True.
I'm kind of going to assume that they're only going to bring the Russians on board. Basically, they're very close allies.
I could see that. I could see that. That's fair. That's a fair assumption.
Not that that's what I want. I want them to bring on, you know, United States astronauts as well, but we'll see.
We'll see. But yeah, speaking of stations and space shuttles, this barely made it into the end of the month, but Space Shuttle Endeavour has been lifted into place to complete the space shuttle stack in California. There's a lot of S's there.
Yeah, that's like a tongue twister right there. Say that five times fast.
Space shuttle stack. That's it could get pretty hard. I don't know. For the first time since 2011, a space shuttle is standing upright. Around 9:30 at night, January 29th, two cranes lifted Endeavour using the same assembly used to hoist it in the vehicle assembly building back at KSC. The operation took about 9.5 hours, and the orbiter now stands mated to its flight-rated fuel tank. Next on the list is a steel shell to protect Endeavour during the remaining 18 months of construction of the Science Center. There's about 100 other air and spacecraft to be put into the building, and numerous exhibits to install also.
That sounds awesome. We need to go there when it's open.
I was just about to say. So the center plans on opening one of Endeavour's payload doors as well, stuffing a flown module inside, and then constructing a 20-story viewing gantry for the public to see inside. So this is going to be super cool, like you said. I'm still a little salty about LA getting this instead of Houston or Florida, but yeah, that definitely won't stop me from making the stop down there.
Yeah, no, definitely. On shuttles in progress, we actually have quite some exciting news about Blue Origin coming through. Blue Origin, or as I like to call it, Amazon Space, continues to work on their New Glenn rocket. I believe we've covered some news very briefly about New Glenn in the past related to some Blue Origin / Amazon news.
I think so.
It was about Amazon's new satellite facility where we mentioned that Amazon plans to launch a few thousand satellites,
yes,
contributing to the whole problem with space junk. So not only are we getting junk from our Amazon orders being wrong, but we're getting space junk as well. Great.
Shots fired.
Anyways, enough of space junk and Amazon junk. Back to New Glenn. So New Glenn is a multi-stage rocket, Blue Origin's first multi-stage rocket, as New Shepard is just a single suborbital launch vehicle.
Yes.
Blue Origin has attached the two stages of the rocket together for the first time, which is the news for this month. So New Glenn will only be two stages from what I can tell, and they plan to launch their first one later this year. Very similar to SpaceX's Falcon 9, and in fact plans to be a direct competitor to SpaceX's offerings, which is great news as competition in the space industry is always welcome, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah, sure.
The two-stage rocket will stand 322 feet or 98 meters tall and be able to haul about 50 tons to low Earth orbit.
That's impressive.
Yes, exactly, and it's twice the payload capacity of the Falcon 9, which is, you know, like I said, I looked it up for this. And also, it was in the article too, but I confirmed.
Yeah, that's crazy. Okay.
It's also designed to be reusable, just like the Falcon 9. It's powered by 7 of Blue Origin's BE-4 engines, which flew for the first time earlier this month on the debut flight of United Launch Alliance's new Vulcan Centaur rocket. Do you remember the Vulcan Centaur?
I do.
Excellent, because that was a great launch. However, the payload failed because that was the Peregrine lander.
Yes.
That was taken up. Yeah, so just real brief summary. The Peregrine lander was supposed to land on the moon, but it had some issues, a very major fuel leak. So yes, it wasn't going to make it to, it wasn't even going to make it into orbit, I think, was the ultimate problem. So what they did instead is they sent it around the moon, they brought it back, and it just burned up in the atmosphere, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Anyways, so I think, speaking of the engines especially, this will contribute to the success of the first New Glenn launch, considering the fact that these engines were rock solid and it was a very successful launch on the Vulcan Centauri, or Centaur rocket. The first flight of New Glenn is currently scheduled for this coming August. So, you know, we are not far out at all, you know.
Yeah, that's actually happening a lot quicker than I thought it would.
Yeah, I was thinking latest or earliest, like late 2024.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe early 25. Yeah, that's pretty impressive. I had no idea that it was going to be such a capable rocket. Did they say, I mean, as far as the reusable aspect goes, are they thinking just like splashdown and recovery? Or there's
I did not look that far into it.
There's no way they're going to be able to do it. I'd be extremely surprised if they were able to recover them via landing like the Nines, considering how long it took SpaceX to perfect that. But yeah. I don't know. I mean, I won't knock it against them, but I would say maybe splashdown.
It's like, it could be like splashdown, kind of like
Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab's doing that now, right? Is it Rocket Lab or yes, not Relativity Space, Rocket Lab.
It should be Rocket Lab. Kind of like that. And then also, weren't the SRBs on the space shuttle reusable?
As far as reusable goes,
they splashed down and they were able to recover. Down.
Yes. I'm not sure how much they reused them and stuff. I'd never really looked into it because it was kind of before.
No, I just know that of the parts of the space shuttle, the only part that they didn't keep was the massive orange fuel tank, I should say.
Yes.
Anyways, back to New Glenn again. It will launch NASA's two spacecraft Escapade Mars mission, which I didn't really look into this. As far as I know, it's just the name. Escape and Plasma Acceleration and Dynamics Explorers.
Huh. Okay, that sounds complicated. I guess we'll figure that out in August.
But the crazy thing is this is going to Mars on a New Glenn, you know? So That just speaks further to the capabilities of this rocket that Amazon Blue Origin is claiming.
Well, we have good news on Starliner. Boeing and NASA have made tremendous progress, and Starliner is on track for its mid-April launch date. For anybody new here, Starliner has been suffering from several delays ahead of its first crewed flight test, the latest being due to weak parachute links and flammable wiring tape. Well, they've modified the parachute system and proved its worth in a recent drop test in Arizona. Boeing also removed close to 4,300 feet of the flammable tape where feasible. And in areas not, they wrapped another non-flammable chafe-resistant tape on top and installed fire breaks on the wiring harness.
That's a solution for sure.
Yes.
I wonder what made it not possible to get to that tape.
It was. It had to do something with they were going to damage equipment if they attempted to remove it in those areas.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
So yeah, I'm not sure how you damage equipment by removing the tape on the wires, but hey, I'm not a rocket scientist.
Yeah. No, we're not even close.
Sadly.
Go to school, man.
Right. Now, Blake and I actually have a buddy, Jonathan, whose uncle works at NASA, and he was telling me his uncle was involved in some of their recent ascent simulations at the training center at KSC with astronauts Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams, who will be the ones going up in this thing in April. So that's pretty cool stuff. He sent me a tweet NASA made, and his uncle was standing in the background. Yeah, pretty neat.
Yeah, that's cool. Shout out to Jonathan.
Shout out to Jonathan and his uncle. And I have good news on Artemis also. Yes, it's still delayed, but NASA continues to push forward, making progress on the Space Launch System, or SLS, rocket that will take astronauts to the moon next year. A test fire was conducted of the RS-25 engine on January 17th. The test lasted about as long as the launch would be, around 8.5 minutes. As far as I know, the test was successful, and I'm sure they'll be looking over the data to find places for improvement and potential errors. For you rocket nerds, yes, the RS-25 is the same engine that was used on the space shuttle. NASA has reconfigured and upgraded the design to fit the mission requirements of Artemis.
Nerd.
Thanks.
We have in the news a bunch of things available to the public to us, right? Well, however, nowadays, we don't really hear much about the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, if you would. The U.S. Department of Defense wants to declassify more space programs. So kind of more like what I've gathered is that they believe this will give the military an edge in space over our current competitors, China and Russia, if you would.
Okay.
It's believed that some of the programs that remain highly classified can be brought down a level or two in classification, thus bringing in more scientists that can't necessarily get the classification, or just, you know, there's something holding them back from getting the classification clearance to be able to work with that. I'm not 100% sure how to word it better, just that these guys can't work on it because they don't have the security clearance to do so. Kathleen Hicks, U.S. Deputy Secretary of Defense, recently approved a new policy that will reduce the classification level of some highly secret space programs and tech. Or at least that will be a result of this policy. The old policies surrounding the top secret space programs are outdated and are holding back the U.S. when it comes to superiority in space, like I said, competing with China and Russia because they're just making great strides right now. The Department of Defense Assistant Secretary for Space Policy, John Plum, states, quote, what the classification memo does generally is it completely rewrites a legacy document that had its roots 20 years ago, and it's just no longer applicable to the current environment that involves national security space. End quote. This leads us to what we've been seeing, a space race in real time. We are living in a space race right now, guys. It's crazy. And to further clarify what I said earlier about bringing down the classification, all these new policies will really do is bring down the classification level so that more scientists can begin working on it without needing to obtain the security clearance necessary. It's going to be brought to such a classification that allows for private industries and international allies to help the U.S. build up its space advantage versus China and Russia. It's super important to note that this does not mean the public will be able to see these top secret space programs, just that those that need to know can know, so to speak.
Fair enough. Yeah, I was really hoping that we get more, I don't know, UFO junk out of Area 51.
That's what I'm saying, man. Like, come on, just show us the aliens already.
Give it to me. Come on.
The new policy doesn't appropriately declassify the programs, but moreover allows each branch of the military to determine how classified they want these programs to be.
Oh.
So, you know, they could take it from whatever the highest classification is called down to a step below that, instead of it generally being like a blanket policy to kind of force it into that way when it's like, this is too top secret. We can't get enough help on it. We need some help to further advance it, you know.
Fair enough. I think that's a decent decision to make.
Well, yeah, me too, because ultimately, why should one entity decide, oh, hey,
what everybody else does?
Yeah. All of this is super classified because it's government related, and it also relates to our national security and stuff like that. So just allowing the Space Force or the Air Force to determine the level of classification for each project or each program independently is quite a step forward, I think.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if you saw this one, Blake, but NASA, in collaboration with Venus Aerospace, a Houston-based company, by the way, have tested a new type of rocket engine. So it's like a rotational engine.
Okay, explain, because we do have gimbaled engines. I know that.
So the
rotational.
Okay.
What's the difference?
So Venus has tested their new rotating detonation engine. Or RDRE, rotating detonation rocket engine, RDRE.
Okay.
Okay. It's the longest test of such an engine at around a 4-minute burn. Typical tests are only a few seconds. Now, a RDRE ignites fuel and oxidizer in a circular motion in an annulus, which is just a fancy word for circular channel. The fuel and oxidizer are injected through small holes, similar to a conventional rocket injector plate, and then an igniter starts the detonation. Afterwards, the detonation is self-sustaining and exhausts. Well, let me rephrase that. It's self-sustaining, and the exhausts expand to supersonic speed and exit through the nozzle. This type of combustion can be up to 25% more efficient than traditional methods. RDRE design is fairly simple with no moving parts, and the nozzle, get this, looks like an aerospike.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, because I was under the impression that the problem with aerospikes were that they got too hot because they don't have the surface area to cool down like a bell nozzle does, and that if you tried using more heat-resistant metals, they got too heavy. But what I'm seeing is these RDREs are rather small, and they're talking about using them on landers and for deep space. So I'm guessing they won't be used in atmosphere and therefore don't need to be all that big. But their high efficiency could mean we could explore further with less wasted fuel and smaller engines. Oh, and did I mention they're 3D printed?
That's pretty sick.
Yeah. So my understanding is, just to kind of wrap it all up, is that they're being made with some new copper alloy that is got much more heat resistance. I guess it's light enough. It's 3D printable. And yeah, these things have kind of an aerospike look to them. No moving parts. They're really just quite small. But yeah, it just ignites the flame continuously in detonation, and this fiery tornado thing going on in the combustion chamber that exits out the aerospike.
That's very interesting.
Seriously, go check out the YouTube video posted by, I think it was NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center. Search RDRE engine test, and this little thing looks pretty mean.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out now that you mention it. All right, y'all, it's time to get real. It brings me great sadness to announce this to our listeners, but the little helicopter that could can no longer.
No more chugga chugga woo woo.
No, no more chugga chugga woo woo. NASA has announced that after 72 flights, Ingenuity won't fly again.
72, man.
Yeah.
Jeez.
I'd like to take a brief moment of silence.
Bah, bah, bah.
Yeah, thanks, Paul.
Sorry.
You're okay. That was actually kind of on the nose. So. Ultimately, I believe that we knew deep down that it would happen. One day, Ingenuity would never fly again. It just sucks that it came so quickly. Yeah. I say quickly. I mean, honestly, it was a few years, actually. I think two, maybe 3 years almost. Almost 3 years, yeah. I've got the dates here. I'll get to them in a minute.
I was about to say, don't get me lying. I know you got it written down.
All of the rovers we've sent to Mars have an end-of-life plan. So that includes our little helicopter. Ingenuity couldn't have been much different. After all, it was only scheduled to take 5 test flights. Anyways, let's not reflect too much on why we're sad. Instead, let's make sure we remember why Ingenuity is such an accomplishment and a marvel of modern space exploration. Originally launched on July 30th of 2020, Ingenuity was first deployed to the Martian surface on April 4th, 2021. Like I said, I had the dates. So, yeah, just under 3 years.
Yeah.
On the 19th of that April, it became the first aircraft in history to make a powered, controlled flight on another planet. Why was this such an accomplishment? I'm glad you asked, Paul.
You're welcome.
According to NASA, flight on Mars is exceptionally difficult given Mars's significantly low gravity, lower gravity than Earth, and incredibly thin atmosphere.
I was about to say, yeah, that atmosphere plays a big role.
Yeah. So to kind of put it into perspective, we're talking a third of Earth's gravity and an atmosphere so thin that it only amounts to about 1% of Earth's atmospheric pressure at the surface.
I had no idea it was that low.
It's extremely thin.
I'm surprised they got any lift on that thing whatsoever.
Same.
Wow.
I mean, I wonder how fast those rotors were going in order to get enough bite out of the air in order to, you know, get some lift.
Well, when you see Ingenuity, it's got twin counter rotating rotors.
It's got
a lot of lift on like this little bitty, looks like a kind of like space foil body. So I guess it's not a whole lot of weight to lift. But yeah, that's really impressive.
That's still quite impressive. Hats off to the team that designed and, you know, simulated Ingenuity on their computers at home. So kudos.
Woohoo.
So using communications from Perseverance, Ingenuity was able to communicate back to Earth, where it would send its data to NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab for analysis. Now, something to remember, this helicopter was only supposed to last 5 test flights, or they only scheduled 5 test flights. Anything after that was bonus.
Yeah, 72.
Yes. After its 5th flight test on May 7th of 2021, Ingenuity embarked on its new purpose, exploring how aerial operations would improve the efficiency of future Mars exploration. The data gathered using Ingenuity's flights over its lifetime was huge and allowed NASA to then begin exploring the idea of small helicopters carrying a suite of instruments for science experiments. One of my favorite little factoids for you, and one of the best things about Ingenuity, was its work done with Perseverance. The two worked together to further enhance Perseverance's ability to explore the Jezero crater on Mars. On its last flight, Ingenuity lost contact with Perseverance, which, as I mentioned earlier, is its communication relay for the rotorcraft.
Uh-huh.
Once communication was finally reestablished, Ingenuity transmitted some imagery showing damaged rotor blades, making it unsafe to fly.
Well, at least it's not like in pieces on the Martian surface.
that is a you know, condolence, I suppose.
You know, isn't Perseverance dropping off Mars samples that we're supposed to hopefully recover?
I'm actually not sure.
I think it is. I want to say I saw a story on that and that they're having issues with that whole program. But if that's the case and we send something to retrieve said sample capsules, we could hopefully retrieve Ingenuity.
Maybe.
That would be nice.
Yeah, that'd be pretty cool. But I don't know, man. Something that I kind of have in my head is there's like, we leave Ingenuity right where it is and we build like a little dome over it.
A little shrine.
Yeah, and make it like a little shrine. So whenever, you know, humans first make it to Mars and we start colonizing Mars in the distant future.
You have like some giant monument. Here lies Ingenuity, the first like controlled
yeah,
space flight.
Here lies Ingenuity, Sojourner, and all the other like Martian rovers. And, you know, that'd be kind of cool. I don't know. That's just, you know, the sci-fi nerd coming out in me, you know, like, I think I may have watched a little too much Star Trek or whatever.
Well, keeping on the topic of Mars, scientists along ESA or ESA have potentially discovered a massive amount of water ice at Mars's equator. ESA's Mars Express orbiter has revisited the Medusae Fossae Formation. I honestly haven't done my research on Mars geology, but we're going to call it the MFF, after an initial discovery made 15 years ago. Initial observations of the region revealed massive deposits some 2.5 kilometers deep. However, it was unclear what these deposits were made of. New data from Mars Express's MARSIS radar shows the deposits to be much thicker than once thought, upwards of 3.7 kilometers, that's over 2 miles, according to Thomas Waters of the Smithsonian Institute. He happens to be the lead author of both the old and new discoveries, by the way. So, thank you, Thomas. The old data showed to be relatively transparent to radar and low in density, an indication of icy deposits, but at the time, scientists attributed it to large deposits of windblown dust. After all, the MFF is one of Mars's largest contributors to dust storms, having been formed from lava flows billions of years ago and rained on constantly by volcanic ash. But the new data tells a different story. According to co-author Andrea Cicchetti?
Cicchetti. I bet that's the only way I can think.
Given how deep the MFF is, it was simply a pile of dust. We'd expect it to become compacted under its own weight. They even tried modeling different ice-free materials, and nothing reproduced the properties of the MFF until they introduced ice. So the new result suggests that instead of MFF being one large deposit of dust, it's actually layers of dust and ice covered by a top layer of dust and ash several hundred meters thick, making it the largest deposit found outside of Mars's poles. This could play a significant role as a potential water source for future manned missions, as these missions would aim at zones closer to the equator, but also poses the issue of how to retrieve said ice. So, pretty
neat. Like that one Michael Bay movie where he sends drillers up to the moon instead of astronauts and teaching them how to drill.
Yeah, that's pretty much going to be it. We're going to be sitting here trying to drill through dust just to get ice out there.
Yeah, that'd be funny.
Yeah.
We mentioned Mars samples, but let's talk about asteroid samples. So, the OSIRIS-REx asteroid sample is kind of finally under investigation. They were able to open it up, but then there was another issue where they couldn't open up part of the capsule that came back. Anyways.
So, they're trying to open up a space pickle jar.
Yes. I mean, I'm telling you, man, just grab, like, you know, the grippy thing and then open it.
Firmly grasp it!
Anyways, brief reminder, OSIRIS-REx is the first American asteroid mission to return back to Earth. There's been a few others. One that I'm going to talk about after this one is actually the Japanese one, which is pretty cool. Anyways, there for a minute, the team working on OSIRIS-REx was unable to open the canister that held the precious cargo. A couple of stuck fasteners have finally been loosened enough to open it and get to the samples. They'll be sent off for analysis and used to discover more about where our solar system came from. As for OSIRIS-REx's mission, it was actually sent to the astronaut Bennu. astronaut Asteroid Bennu, which is a primitive space rock believed to be around since the beginning of our solar system.
We're taking samples out of astronauts now.
Jesus Christ. That's not a good thing. Oh, man. Don't these astronauts know that they have a family? They have a life? I don't know. Anyway, we're hoping to learn more about where we came from, specifically the origins of the solar system, and more about how solar systems might form. So, you know, more universal mysteries to unravel and more fun stuff to learn.
The more the merrier.
I did mention earlier that I was going to talk about a Japanese asteroid sample, and this one's a bit older, but it has been analyzed and might even hold some key answers to what we're doing here, like here on Earth. Detailed investigation of these asteroid samples from asteroid Ryugu, I think I pronounced that right, has provided further evidence that the organic molecules which began life on Earth were originally brought here by ancient comets. These samples were carried on Japan's Hayabusa 2 mission, which visited Ryugu back in 2018 and returned back to Earth in 2020. So why are we just now talking about it? Well, they just released it, the news press conference thing, so that's why we're talking about it.
Usually they hold these things for a while before the story ever gets out.
Yeah. So when we actually get to talk about OSIRIS-REx, it's going to be like 3 years from now.
Yeah.
There, Hayabusa 2 spent 18 months studying Ryugu for answers, collecting surface material for analysis back here on Earth. Ryugu was previously known as 162173 Ryugu, which is a 2,850-foot wide or 870 meters near-Earth asteroid. It lacks a protective atmosphere, which exposes its surface to space so that it can gather whatever there might be out in space. This is beneficial to the study as it allows the asteroid to gather space dust, which then changes the surface of the asteroid. Thanks, space.com, kind of clarified that a little bit for me.
Oh, okay.
Analysis of the asteroid's surface allowed scientists to discover small carbonaceous materials similar to primitive organic matter inside of what they're calling melt splashes. These melt splashes were created when cometary dust pelted the surface of Ryugu. And we'll get to what a melt splash is here in a second.
Yeah, I was just about to ask.
A note on comets, real quick. Comets are space objects that usually exist on wide orbits around the sun. They'll swing way out and they'll come back around the sun, and then, you know, they'll burn up, or the sun will more accurately burn the outside of the comet off, creating what's known as the tail of the comet. Anyways, comets will orbit super far out into the deep reaches of space, freeze up, and then return back near the sun, which then heats the comet up to the point where its surface is instantly vaporized in a process known as sublimation. Or, simply put, when a solid becomes a gas, skipping the liquid stage entirely.
Yes.
This gaseous material carries with it some parts of the comet's surface, which then get launched into outer space. An object, such as asteroid Ryugu, then collides with this gaseous material, creating the melt splashes I mentioned earlier.
So basically, Ryugu is a space sponge.
Yeah, something like that. So researchers on this project are kind of throwing out the theory and inferring that this is one way that life might spread across the universe via these, what they're calling, messenger comets.
Pretty neat stuff.
That's actually quite a solid theory. And honestly, it is the most easily comprehensible theory in my head, that that's how we got here.
Yes. Now, you know, religion aside, of course, but right. But yeah. No, scientifically speaking, yeah, that sounds most correct, to me, at least.
Yeah. All right, listeners, once again, we need to get serious. It's time for Nightmare Fuel.
Oh, it ain't that serious. Come on now.
No, I'm kidding. There's nothing like an asteroid's going to hit the planet Earth, or like, hey, this giant asteroid near missed Earth by a million miles.
Even if it did, I wouldn't tell you guys.
Well, that's the whole plot point of the look up movie or whatever it was called. I forgot.
I don't know. If don't you see an up, asteroid hurtling in the sky, just accept it.
Basically, yeah.
All right. This first one's nothing really, but it will help us get the ball rolling. The second picture of the supermassive black hole, here we go, of M87 has been released. The image was taken on April 21st, 2018. Here we go again with, you know, it's just now being released.
Yeah, we now get to see it we 5 years later. No, it. 6 years later.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It was taken by the Event Horizon Telescope just over a year after the first image of 2017. The image looks a lot like the first, except you'll notice the bright spot has moved about 30 degrees around the black hole. Yeah, it still looks like a blurry orange space donut, but it's a cool orange space donut.
It's about what the orange space donut represents, Paul.
It's abstract art, guys. Come on. Appreciate it.
Please.
Appreciate the space donut.
That's an idea for Merck. Appreciate the space donut. It's just a picture of the...
There we go. Oh, man. The new picture has confirmed the theory that a black hole radius is simply dependent on its mass. If the mass doesn't change, the radius won't shrink or grow. You can find the image all over Google. I'll actually be getting our Instagram going soon so we can start sharing things like this when we see them. But until then, search up new black hole image and it will come right up. You can also find the first image enhanced by X-ray data like we talked about in our last episode. So you can see the effects of X-rays or the effects that X-rays have on clarity. It's actually pretty cool. You get kind of like a spiral effect on the blurry donut.
Yeah.
And continuing on with the topic of imaging and black holes, of course, James Webb sets another record. You may remember us talking about the oldest and largest black holes known to man last year. Blake's already going, oh, God.
No, please.
Here we go.
Please don't.
Well, astronomers with Webb have discovered the new oldest black hole ever seen. It also happens to be the furthest away. Located more than 13 billion light years away, a black hole at the center of a galaxy called GN-Z11 or Z11 is thought to have formed just 400 million years after the Big Bang. Okay, just 400 million years. All right, it's pretty young. The crazy thing isn't just its age, but also its size. It's 1.6 million solar masses, which isn't too crazy in terms of supermassive black holes, but it is when you consider that size in the early universe. Under current theories, black holes simply can't grow that large in the span of 400 million years. In fact, it would take over twice as long at a minimum. This could happen if the black hole formed from the rapid collapse of a giant gas cloud rather than a singular star. The problem is, all the gas still surrounds it, this particular black hole. And it's behaving like it originated in smaller form. Not only that, but it's feeding at rates way higher than previously thought possible. There's a mathematical limit known as the Eddington limit. The Eddington limit is the limit at which the outer pressure of a star or black hole's radiation balances the inward gravitational force. So it's force outward from its own radiating, we'll call it energy, balances the inward force of gravity, okay? Beyond that limit, you start to push material away, resulting in supernovae and quasars if you're a black hole. Well, this black hole is accreting material from its galaxy at a rate 5 times the Eddington limit. Essentially, it's dooming its host galaxy because it's not allowing stars to form by pushing all the dust and gas away. Eventually, this is thought to cease as material the black hole can feed on gets pushed away and slowly runs out, thus allowing it to fall back inward and potentially starting the cycle all over again. But that's just all hypothetical and may never happen if the gases are pushed far enough away. So essentially, we have a super far, super old or young, depending on how you look at it, black hole that's bigger than it should be, blasting away things faster than it should be, eating things quicker than it should be, and dooming its host galaxy all at the same time. So there you go, Blake.
I'm crying. I'm crying just like these solar flares I'm about to talk about. Oh, no. Okay, sorry. Bad joke. Anyways, so I have in my notes, because I like to make little fun little headlines for
in case you guys haven't noticed Blake's puns, my God.
Sorry, it's just a way to lighten up, I guess. Anyways, I called this topic crying solar flares because they're sympathetic solar flares. So, bad joke. Anyway, moving on.
Yeah, what kind of sympathy does a solar flare have?
We'll get to that.
Okay.
So, more on the topic of nightmare fuel, we have a pair of solar flares recently exploded almost simultaneously. So I guess that's where they're getting the sympathetic, like ones, you know, whenever you see someone vomit and you vomit in sympathy.
What?
You've never seen that?
No.
Okay. Well, I don't do that actually, but I've heard of it.
You had to pick that as your example for sympathy. You could put anything else to sympathize with.
No, like the imagery, man. So
yes,
like,
that's wonderful. That's like your snake star swallowing things whole before you go to bed.
Yeah.
You need some help.
Not really. I think I'm okay. Anyways, so moving on. So the solar flares recently exploded almost simultaneously from two different sunspots on the opposite hemispheres of the sun. And an extremely rare phenomenon known as the talked about sympathetic solar flares just goes to show that we're fast approaching solar maximum in the sun's solar cycle, which we've talked about previously. So if you haven't, check out our previous episodes. On January 22nd, the pair of flares known as AR3559 and AR3561 erupted at around 10:30 p.m. Eastern Time.
Okay.
They were separated by around 310,000 miles, or about 500,000 kilometers, which is further than the average distance between the moon and the Earth. This eruption triggered a 30-minute radio blackout above Indonesia and parts of Australia. It's a magnitude 5.1, which is the second most powerful class of flare the sun can produce. So yeah, more solar flares. I swear we talk about solar flares every week.
Sympathetic vomiting solar flares, yes.
Well, yes, that was just an example because it wasn't right at the same time. It's just like, you know, that moment where someone sees someone throw up and then they...
I can't believe we're still...
I'm committed to it now, dude.
No. I hope none of you are eating while you listen to this.
Yeah. Sorry.
Way to go.
I apologize. And therefore, it's over. It's done. Moving on. That wraps it up for the news this week. Let's go ahead and move on to our listener questions.
All right. So we had two, I think, I wanted to go over here for this episode. Our first one was, when something happens in a launch, how do they go back and figure out what went wrong? The answer is fairly simple, and I think we kind of went over this a little bit way, way back. But bottom line is that they have like real-time telemetry on board these things.
Yeah, so they have hundreds, if not thousands, of sensors on board just to kind of look at the data, right?
Yes. Like, so if you look at mission control, you got all those different stations. They're all monitoring something different, you know, from engines to life support systems to, you know, fuel pressures, communications, electronics, avionics, and navigation, you know, all that stuff. So it's all monitored in real time. And then I'm sure all recorded as it's sent back. So basically, I mean, that's pretty much it. Now, if you recover your vessel, if you have a way of recovering it, I'm sure that you can look into things after the fact, especially like a good example would be when they recover a capsule, when they look at stuff like the heat shield and check thicknesses of the heat shield and conditions in certain areas. They can look at how to improve it, you know, check the parachute harnesses and things like that, like physical things. Once you recover a craft, you can look at all kinds of stuff like that. But really, to go back to the main question, you know, when something happens in a launch, you may not be recovering it. So it really relies a lot on that real-time telemetry coming back. So
yeah, and it's a lot of data, and they're able to kind of like run simulations that, you know,
could replicate it.
Yeah, replicate it. And like if it's a math equation, okay, so we have the solution to the math equation. Let's solve it on the other side to get that solution, you know, kind of something like that.
Yes. Let's see. And then I think that wraps that up. But our second question was something I keep meaning to mention, and I don't know why I haven't for so darn long. Are y'all excited for the solar eclipse coming up? And the answer is
absolutely.
Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, just the fact that we live relatively close to the path of totality is really cool. We are planning on traveling out to West Texas in order to hopefully take some images.
Yes. And if we do, like I said, we're trying to get that Instagram up. So you will probably see them there if we're successful, fingers crossed. But yeah, that eclipse is on April 8th. It's going to go basically across the U.S. And I think it exits North America somewhere north of Maine, I want to say. And then as it travels out into the ocean, you kind of reach like the nighttime part of Earth and whatnot. And so it's just no longer visible. But yeah, Blake and I are going to be making the trek out and go out to West Texas and try and get a look at this thing. I took a flight down to Kerrville recently, and the guys there at the airport were telling me that they've got literally like hundreds of aircraft reserved already to fly in. They've got NASA's going to, I think, come down to Kerrville and do coverage from Kerrville. They got to shut down an entire runway. They're going to park like 100 aircraft on it. So it's going to be pretty crazy. If you plan on seeing it and you haven't made any sort of reservations or plans, time's really running out for you.
If you're lucky, you'll be able to get something. But so, if you haven't at this point, I think you're out of luck.
Yeah. Honestly. I mean, if I were you, what I would do, if you don't have any like hotel reservations or anything, right? You know, stay somewhere as close as you can get to the path. And then, you know, you got to like drive in. It's going to have to be like early morning or the night before. And get yourself within that path, you know, somewhere. Even if it's like outside of a town somewhere, you know, find somewhere away from people, away from the traffic. But yeah, because this is the last one
in North America
for, I want to say like 20, maybe even 30 years or something like that. 20 or 30. And I want to say one of the like longest that we've had, like totality will be like the longest. And I want to say in the middle, it's something like 4.5 minutes long of totality. But yeah, hopefully that answers your question. We're super stoked.
Yeah, we are. And also another thing to mention, get your solar eclipse glasses now. Don't wait. Get them now.
You can look at, if you can't get them at a local store somewhere, look at Amazon. You can look at all the major like telescope distributors. You got like Agena Astro, High Point Scientific. Let's see. Well, you got Celestron sells them directly.
And then you could probably also buy some from Orion, which is telescope.com.
Telescopes.com or telescope.com.
I think it's just telescope, but either way.
Yeah. Any one of those guys, go ahead and put them on order. You can usually get like boxes of them, multiples. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I know this is just a Texas thing, but our local grocery store, HEB, I actually saw them start putting them out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And I think also I've seen them at Kroger, which is a national chain. They have different names elsewhere, but I did see them at Kroger, I think. So they were full, but they won't be full in probably a matter of a week or two.
Yeah, once it really starts being covered on the news, you know, in the couple weeks leading up to it, you know, they'll probably say, you know, every day, hey, you know, here's a countdown to the eclipse. And yeah, so you better get ready. As a reminder, you only need the glasses before and after totality. During totality, you can take the glasses off. You can use your binoculars, no filters, you know, whatever, you know, you can look at it. Just be careful. You got to get those darn things back on, you know, before totality ends.
Yeah.
So,
you know, give yourself a good solid maybe minute or two if you're playing a risky game.
I wouldn't say necessarily that long, but yeah, I mean, if you start to see like the marbles or something again, you know, just be ready. Just be safe. Yeah. That's all we're saying.
Be safe. Protect your eyes. You only have two. That wraps it up for us this week. Thanks for tuning in and listening to us tell you all about the exciting things that are happening in the aerospace industry and in space. And also the nightmare fuel stuff, because we keep doing that.
Can't help it.
Yeah, I know. If you like what you're hearing, leave us a comment, a review, and a rating. It helps us spread the word and reach more people. We'd really appreciate all of your kind words. Be sure to check out our website, spaceweek.co, where you can find out more about Space Week and keep up to date with our latest episodes. You'll also be able to find links to all of our social media, including Facebook and the upcoming Instagram. It's in the works.
Well, that's about it. Keep your eyes on the skies. This is Paul
and Blake
signing off.